It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a new national report that examines the experiences of LGBTQ plus people in the criminal legal system. And it attempts to look beyond the data that says the incarceration rate of people who self-identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual is three times that of the general U.S. population. Join in on your experiences or that of a loved one in the system and part of a marginalized community. 800-642-1234. Jane Harith is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. She is author of this report on overrepresentation of people who identify as LGBTQ plus in the criminal legal system, published by the Safety and Justice Challenge. Jane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You found it difficult to count the number of LGBTQ plus people in the criminal legal system. And from what you gathered, how often are LGBTQ plus people being arrested?
Sure. This report, like you said, is commissioned by the MacArthur Foundation. And in it, I compiled some of the existing research documenting overrepresentation of LGBTQ plus individuals within various stages of the criminal legal system. So arrest, incarceration, as well as some of the harmful experiences that people have once they're inside jails and prisons. And like you said, it is very difficult to measure how many folks inside identify as LGBTQ plus. Some of the reasons for that are that a lot of the data regarding arrest and incarceration is collected by criminal legal system institutions. For example, the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and they have not traditionally asked questions about gender identity or sexual orientation on surveys. And then another issue is that knowing how much bias, discrimination, and violence LGBTQ plus individuals are subjected to when they're inside jails and prisons, a lot of folks choose not to self-identify as LGBTQ plus, would feel uncomfortable sharing that information even if it were asked on a survey. So it's very challenging to really accurately represent how many folks inside identify as LGBTQ plus. But the existing research that has been conducted both inside or of folks once they've been released and they're out back in the community and it's a little safer to self-identify indicates, like you said, that gay, lesbian, bisexual individuals are over two times more likely to be arrested. Gay, lesbian, bisexual individuals are three times as likely to be incarcerated. Transgender individuals, particularly transgender women of color, experience very high rates of arrest and incarceration. So the small amount of research that we do have indicates very high rates of arrest and incarceration.
I want to pick up on one note you said there. The justice system, the Justice Department, mm-hmm. you said they traditionally haven't asked about gender identity in their surveys. Do they ask now?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there is a movement to start including some of these questions. So I think they are starting to be included more and more. But like I said, there's still this issue of folks feeling uncomfortable self-identifying on a survey. Mm-hmm. And so that's unlikely to change until we have that's not an easy solution, like adding things to a survey. There's a lot of work to do to create conditions where folks feel more comfortable self-identifying.
Is this the case of overrepresentation in the adult and the juvenile prison system?
Absolutely. The existing research indicates particularly high rates of arrest and detainment in juvenile justice detention facilities for LGBTQ plus youth, particularly lesbian, bisexual, cisgender girls, and transgender youth. So youth seem to be particularly impacted. And we see that looking at other outcomes related to LGBTQ plus youth as well. We know that a large percentage of homeless youth identify as LGBTQ plus. So there's all these other sort of intertwined issues related to marginalization. And the over-incarceration piece is just one part of that story.
We're talking about this new report on incarceration rates of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people with UW-Milwaukee social work faculty Jane Harith. You can join at any point here, 800-642-1234. Jane, let's look at solitary confinement. You cited a survey that found 85% of incarcerated LGBTQ plus people had been in solitary at some point. How is it being used?
Yeah, so that that statistic in particular came from a great survey that was conducted by an organization called Black and Pink that supports LGBTQ plus individuals who are currently incarcerated. So they were able to get, because they're a community-based organization, get some really great information regarding the experiences of folks who are inside. And they found that in some cases, LGBTQ plus individuals would prefer to be in some sort of solitary or protected housing designation when they're inside jails and prisons in order to protect them from discrimination and victimization. But in a lot of cases, they found that individuals were placed in solitary confinement, and it was not what those individuals had chosen or wanted. And so, again, the reasons for that often a institution will state is for the incarcerated person's protection. And yet we know there are all these harmful consequences associated with solitary confinement or isolation. There's some emerging research that indicates very negative mental health consequences. So there's some important conversations here to be had about how to protect people's safety, how to prevent victimization in ways that don't worsen mental health outcomes and create these other harmful consequences.
Right. Such a double-edged sword there. The prison system would point out that solitary confinement, like you said, is being used to protect that individual in prison, to protect them from other prisoners. Is there any basis for that? Because as you mentioned, solitary can have such emotional, physical, mental stresses.
Right. Institutions, of course, are trying to protect themselves from lawsuits, from other harmful consequences of folks experiencing victimization. So that is the solution that has been come up with often. However, like you said, we know that it creates all these other harmful mental health outcomes for folks. And it also may not protect against victimization, because at least according to the survey conducted by Black and Pink, a lot of LGBTQ plus individuals are experiencing victimization by prison staff and guards. So it's sort of a band-aid solution, which is not actually solving the problem of victimization, and it's creating all these other problems of negative mental health consequences. And really the broader solution is to address these larger issues of discrimination and bias against LGBTQ plus individuals.
Looking at HIV treatment, and you said HIV treatment is one area where LGBTQ plus inmates are regularly denied inclusive health care. What did you see there in the system in regards to HIV treatment?
There is a little bit of a positive story there related to HIV treatment. It used to be that access to HIV treatment, regardless of LGBTQ plus identity, was hit or miss inside of jails and prisons. And that the research indicates that access to HIV treatment inside of jails and prisons, particularly in prisons where people are incarcerated for longer amounts of time, that HIV, access to HIV treatment has improved in over the last couple decades of the HIV epidemic. What the research indicates now is a huge issue is folks not having continued access to care once they've been released.
So continuity of care.
Exactly.
Once they transition from prison back to the community, can they continue their treatments?
Exactly. And we know that continuity of care is critically important for keeping viral load down for folks who are HIV positive and reducing the transmission of HIV. So access to care in the community for folks who are back home on probation or parole is a big issue. So HIV care is certainly an issue. And I also highlight in the report something that continues to be a huge issue for a lot of folks is access to gender-affirming medical care. So for folks who are transgender, who are trying to access hormones or other forms of gender-affirming care, They may not be able to get it in their institution. The doctors that are working inside of jails and prisons may not be familiar with the standards of care for transgender individuals. And they're subjected to bias and discrimination of staff and medical providers within jails and prisons, choosing not to provide the care that folks need because of bias against transgender individuals. So that's a huge issue that is ongoing, and some institutions across the country are working to address it, but it's really continues to be very hit or miss.
Jane Harith with us, part of the social work faculty at UW-Milwaukee's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Her new report looks at factors contributing to the overrepresentation of LGBTQ plus people in the criminal legal system. Join in on the system, the policies, the practices that may be biased against LGBTQ plus individuals. What solutions look like here? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing this new national report that brings together research on how lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people are overrepresented at every stage of the criminal legal system, and where the research and policies go from here. Still time to talk about your experience in the prison system, being incarcerated and part of the LGBTQ plus community. 800-642-1234. We have UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor of Social Work Jane Harith, author of the report, stays with us. Jane, picking up on the bias and discrimination of staff, you mentioned bias perhaps against transgender inmates who may not receive appropriate health care. I'm wondering, what recommendations do you have for the criminal legal system to enact and enforce non-discrimination policies for staff? What would you recommend there for educating staff?
Related to the healthcare question, I think one of the really important pieces is to have folks, medical providers, advocates from outside of jails and prisons be supporting access to medical care, also supporting decisions about housing designations for transgender and gender expansive individuals. I think it may not be possible in all cases for jails and prisons to provide the appropriate amount of training to really address bias in time to meet the current pressing needs of individuals that are within inside of jails and prisons. So having outside folks come in and be part of the decision-making teams, I think would be one step that could be taken right away that would support the needs of folks who are currently incarcerated. And then on longer term, one of the goals of the MacArthur Foundation and their Safety and Justice Challenge is to really think about how we're using jails and prisons to address broader social issues. And this report is really trying to highlight the ways in which we're using jails and prisons to control gender expression and sexual orientation. And so we need to have broader conversations. We need to create wide-scale social change to change the way that we perceive LGBTQ plus individuals and to work towards greater equality and liberation.
Along those lines, I was reading the prison policy initiative calling out issues of youth being pushed toward these criminalized behaviors like drug sales and theft and mm-hmm. what they called survival sex, all which would increase the risk of arrest. And so what do you make of those social issues, whether it be homelessness or something else that affect whether someone will be pushed into the criminal legal system?
Right. In the report, I try to go beyond just presenting the statistics about rates of arrest and incarceration and delve into some of these pathways that lead up to involvement in the criminal legal system. And like you said, particularly for youth, one one common pathway that we've seen again and again in the research that I've seen in my own experience working with LGBTQ plus youth as a social worker is youth experiencing homelessness, and often that is due to family rejection when youth come out as LGBTQ plus. Not always, but a large number of youth report experiencing homelessness after being kicked out or pushed out by their families. And then from there, youth are involved, are experiencing homelessness. They're involved in forms of criminalized survival, like theft or sex work, in order to meet their basic needs. And all of those things, homelessness, theft, sex work, are all criminalized behaviors. They're all things that could lead to young people coming into contact with the police and potentially being arrested and then incarcerated. And so when we think about this overrepresentation in the system, it helps to back up a little bit, look at these pathways, and think about where are the points of intervention that we might be able to target to prevent people, particularly young people, from getting swept up into the system to begin with. And so to me, I really think about support for families of LGBTQ plus youth in order to prevent family rejection. I think about housing programs, employment programs. I talk in the report a little bit about the importance of name change support for transgender or gender expansive individuals, because it can be hard to get a job if your legal ID has a name or a picture that doesn't match how you identify or the name that you're using presently. You know, things like supporting survivors of victimization. That's another pathway by which people enter the system, is experiencing intimate partner violence or bullying in school, and then defending themselves and then getting into trouble for doing that. So there's all these things that are related to the criminal legal system, but are also a couple steps before, that are ways that we can intervene. And folks, regardless of even if folks are not working within the criminal legal system, if you are working in a school, or you are working with young people, or you know young people, you're a parent or family member of young people, there's lots of steps that we can all take in order to better meet the needs of LGBTQ plus individuals, particularly youth, and then start to solve this problem.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about marginalized groups and representation in the criminal justice system with UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor of Social Work Jane Harith, who authored this report. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jane, you talk about several organizations that are working to reduce how often LGBTQ plus people are disproportionately involved in the system. Can you name some names here of these organizations and what they're doing? Like, for instance, Breakout.
Sure. Yeah. Breakout is a New Orleans-based organization. They work a lot with LGBTQ plus youth. And they do a lot of the types of things that I just mentioned. They support folks through the legal name change process. They provide know your rights training, so young people know what to do if they're stopped by the police. And that can really help to de-escalate conflict, reduce the likelihood of arrest. There's also an organization called Black and Pink, which I mentioned. Their national organization did this, the survey that I was talking about earlier with currently incarcerated folks. There's also a Black and Pink Milwaukee organization, and they primarily, the Milwaukee organization primarily supports a pen pal letter writing program to currently incarcerated LGBTQ plus individuals. And that's a great way just to provide some social support to address those issues of isolation and negative mental health consequences that we talked about earlier, and also just to provide a link to folks on the outside so that folks who are inside can talk about some of the issues they're experiencing. I know I have a pen pal, she's a transgender woman, and being able to talk about her lack of access to hormones and try to brainstorm with her what can be done about that has, I think it's been helpful for her. So just having a connection to folks on the outside can be really, really important. So folks can get involved in Black and Pink Milwaukee and find a pen pal if they're interested, but also just support their organization in other ways as well, if that's not something that folks are interested in. So I'd really encourage people, especially in the Wisconsin area, to check out Black and Pink Milwaukee.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this report.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for bringing attention to this issue.
Jane Harith is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Milwaukee. We have a link to her report. It's published recently by the Safety and Justice Challenge. It was commissioned by the MacArthur Foundation. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead on the morning show, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter details the latest news from the state's election for U.S. Senate this year. We recap a variety of developments in recent days and look ahead to a busy fall. You can join in on the U.S. Senate race, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We zoom in now on the U.S. Senate race ahead of Tuesday's primary, as all signs point to Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes to take on GOP incumbent Senator Ron Johnson in November. Three of Barnes's main rivals dropped out last week. So what would the race between Barnes and Johnson look like, with the bigger picture there of what party will control the U.S. Senate? Join in on issues that matter to you at the ballot box, the money raised on each side of this race, negative advertising, what you're seeing. 800-642-1234. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in Eau Claire following this race. Rich, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be back.
So 538's U.S. Senate forecast currently gives Barnes a 32% chance of unseating Senator Ron Johnson this November. What are the challenges there to defeating an incumbent politician?
Well, with any incumbent, there's always the name recognition issue. Johnson's been on the ballot since 2010. He also is a formidable candidate. It seems like regardless of what his, favorability or unfavorability polling is, he generally squeaks out the wins. He beat former, U.S. Senator, the Democrat, Russ Feingold twice. Feingold was kind of he was super well known in Wisconsin as mm-hmm. progressive. And yet Johnson beat him twice. And even though polling has showed that he is underwater in terms of favorability right now, the latest polling was that 46% of people surveyed by the Marquette University Law School saw him in an unfavorable light. He is, he's still considered the favorite in this race. And that could be for a number of reasons. Generally, midterm elections, when the party in power in the White House doesn't do very well, we've got inflation going on right now, and it's all going to come down to messaging. Essentially, Republicans are going to run on tying Joe Biden to these candidates, and they've already gone to work painting Mandela Barnes, the state lieutenant governor and front runner in the Democratic Senate primary, as a radical. So, and it's just, I talked with someone with the Cook Political Report, and they said it's just not a favorable year for Democrats in these Senate races. There's really only two states where it's a viable option that Democrats could flip, Wisconsin being one of the top.
Mm. I wonder if we could pause here, because if Lieutenant Governor Barnes would be successful, he would be our state's first Black senator. And I'm wondering if you can put that reality for a moment into sharper focus for us in the context of the campaign trail, in the context of this race. What does that mean?
It would be historic for Wisconsin. It would definitely be historic. He was the first lieutenant governor, first Black individual elected to lieutenant governor, second Black individual to win statewide office in the state ever. So he's already had kind of a historic rise in state politics, and now he's trying to jump into the national spotlight He already has, obviously, but a win against Ron Johnson. I mean, it's going to be national attention is going to be just focused like a laser beam on Wisconsin anyway, because of the nature of this Senate race, because of Ron Johnson's vulnerabilities, and because of the amount of money that's going to be pouring into the state from Democratic and Republican sources. So that's it, got the opportunity to be historic by itself, just the spending. And then, of course, yeah, you've got this young candidate. He would be one of the youngest people in the Senate if Barnes was elected, if Barnes defeated Johnson. But it's likely to be a close race, from what I'm told. And it's going to be a very expensive race. We're all going to see lots and lots more campaign ads on TV. And I'm told that they're likely going to be pretty negative. Each side is going to paint the other candidate as a radical.
We're going to talk about the money and the messaging in a moment, but let's look at who's dropped out, because last week, three of the four leading candidates for the Democratic Senate primary nomination, they dropped out and they endorsed Mandela Barnes. Can you tell us about what transpired there?
Yeah, it was really wild. Again, this Jessica Taylor is who I talked to at the Cook Political Report. She follows Senate and governor's races nationwide. And a lot of people look to Cook for their analysis in these things. And she said that essentially that the entire field of front runners, let's be clear about that, there are other candidates, but the front runners other than Mandela Barnes dropped out within days. And they all endorsed Barnes. So you've got Tom Nelson. He was the first to take the plunge. His campaign on June 25th announced that he was suspending his run. He polled at around 7% in June with Democratic voters, or voters that were likely to vote for him in the primary. He endorsed Barnes. So that was news. That was interesting. Oh, wow. And then Alex Lazary. That one was the biggest shocker, because in the polling, Lazary was really close with Barnes, you know, kind of within that margin of error with regards to the voters that plan to vote for a Democrat in the fall, in the primary on August 9th. So,
and notable and also, there too, is how amicable this has been. Like no bitterness in the dropping out, but being extremely supportive in getting behind Barnes.
Absolutely. 100%. And actually, I mean, talk about supportive. After Lazary dropped out, he released a campaign commercial attacking Ron Johnson. So that was just something else. And also, you know, Lazary, he put in a lot of work. He put in a lot of his own money into his campaign, spent more than $12 million that he loaned to his own campaign. So that was really something. That one, I think, was the most surprising. And then, of course, when Lazary dropped out on July 27th, people went right to Sarah Godlewski, the state treasurer, and another Democratic Senate candidate, and asked her, are you going to drop out as well? On that day, she said no. 2 days later, she dropped out and endorsed Mandela Barnes. And that's another campaign that spent some money. She spent about $4 million of her own money on the campaign. And going back to that the amicable nature of this race, the primary race, it really was something. You know, it was a stark contrast to what's going on with the Republican gubernatorial primary race, where you've got some mudslinging going on. For the most part, the front runners in the Democratic campaign didn't even mention each other by name. The exception to that was Tom Nelson, who's the Outagamie County executive. He got a little feisty, and he attacked Lazary's wealth. He attacked Lazary and Barnes for their support of $250 million in taxpayer funds that went to the Fiserv Forum. And he even took a shot at Sarah Godlewski at the U.S. Senate, the Democratic Senate primary debate just recently. But none of that seemed to land. None of that seemed to get him very much traction. But overall, the candidates just didn't even mention each other. They focused on Ron Johnson, and they really tried to separate themselves in terms of policy items.
talking with Rich Kramer, Eau Claire-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, who is following the upcoming elections for U.S. Senate. You can join in what you see out of this race, 800-642-1234. Rich, you talk about the money. Both Alex Lazary and Sarah Godlewski loaned millions of dollars to their campaigns before dropping out. Ron Johnson, multimillionaire businessman. What role is personal wealth having in the electoral process?
It gets your message out. A lot of people would tell you, well, it's not, money doesn't win elections, but it certainly gets your name out there. It whether people like it or not, they recognize you and they're able to remember the name and some of your issues. And so it has a huge impact. And even though Lazary and Godlewski poured some of their own money into their campaign, let's be clear that Mandela Barnes has had no lack of support. His campaign has raised millions of dollars. I think last week it was over $7 million. They've spent quite a lot. And also that doesn't even account for groups, these outside political action type groups that, mm-hmm. that don't necessarily show up in these campaign finance reports, but there was ads supporting Barnes that included some language that his campaign put out in terms of, if you're going to make an ad here, here's the message. And it was nearly identical. So a lot of people are rallying to Barnes's side in this.
Well, on the topic of negative ads, Ron Johnson in a recent campaign ad accuses the Biden administration of wasteful deficit spending. And the ad says Johnson would say no to further deficit spending in Congress. Let's take a listen.
From the grocery store to the gas station, we're all paying the price for Biden's massive deficit spending. Ron Johnson has the courage to say no to wasteful deficit spending that is mortgaging our children's future.
So wasteful deficit spending mortgaging our children's future. What do you see there in the tactics of these type of ads?
Well, that to me speaks to the how large an issue inflation and rising costs will play. Will be in this race. That obviously is a swipe at Biden, and they're trying to paint President Biden as the sole cause for all these inflationary increases. It's obviously there's more to it than that, but it's easy to blame the person in power, and it's very convenient for Republicans that are hoping to have a concise message to kind of cut through all the policy items that challengers on the Democratic side will try to put out in campaign ads of their own.
In the end, it's people's pocketbooks that matter. And that right there will be, as you say, this a focus of the messaging.
Right. And for example, again, not to go back to the Marquette poll too much, but the June Marquette poll found that, you know, they poll various issues. What's on the top of your mind as we near these elections, the primary and the general? Inflation was like top of the list by mm-hmm. far, and mm-hmm. that was not long after Roe v. Wade was overturned, the federal abortion protections was overturned. So it's just, you know, what's the old saying, it's the economy, stupid. So it's definitely going to play into one way or the other into campaign ads. And one thing that I wanted to point out too is when I went to the Democratic State Party convention in La Crosse, I noticed that all the candidates, you know, they've got similar policy, you know, agendas and little variations. But one thing that I didn't hear a lot of was the word inflation. They would kind of tiptoe around it. There was some mention of increasing costs, but I have noticed that Mandela Barnes put out a new ad from his campaign, and he mentions, you know, inflation. So it's going to be interesting to see how Barnes and other Democratic Senate candidates or congressional candidates around the nation try to frame that and use it somehow.
Mm-hmm. WPR reporter Rich Kramer with us on the campaign trail following developments in the U.S. Senate race, as Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is likely to challenge U.S. Senator Ron Johnson in November's midterms. Join in on stark contrasts you see in this race, how inflation plays into it, how you see Barnes and Johnson align with their party values or not, and your thoughts about negative ads. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're breaking down the U.S. Senate race as top Democratic rivals of Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. They dropped out of the race, endorsed his campaign last week, clearing the way for Barnes to challenge Senator Ron Johnson in November. Join in on what you would expect from a Barnes and Johnson matchup, what you will be watching for as the campaign season heats up. 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Rich Kramer has been covering this race and stays with us. Let's bring on a call now. Jeff is with us from Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. I just want to say it's disappointing to me how both parties seem to always gravitate towards the most extreme candidate and put them up in the election. And even if you're thinking of maybe voting for a party you don't normally vote for, you just can't, because it's always such an extreme example of the views of that party. And in this case, the voters never had a chance to decide who would run as their candidate. All of a sudden, the field is cleared and there wasn't even a primary election. I mean, I would have liked to have known more about Tom Nelson from Outagamie County. Maybe he would have been a little bit more middle of the road, but never had a chance to hear about him. And, you know, these people put their heart and souls into these elections, lots of money. What is it that just caused them to suddenly overnight drop out? And that's just a real disappointment to me.
Jeff, thank you for bringing that to the table and for that observation. Rich, what do you make of that? All the Democrats dropped out before voters had a say.
Right. Yeah, Jeff brings up a good point. I mean, Senator Johnson has already attacked Democrats, you know, overall for taking that choice away from voters. I've been told that in, you know, having a spirited and not an ugly kind of a Democratic Senate primary election, and it gives voters some enthusiasm. It gives them choices. But now they're not going to have that. The other side of the coin there is that now the funders know who to give the money to. I looked at the campaign finance reports essentially overnight after, you know, Mandela Barnes was essentially the nominee. Again, there's still an election and it's not a sure thing, but he's very heavily favored. And the amount of money just changed on these campaign finance reports overnight. Ron Johnson brought in a ton of money. And a lot of new donations came into Mandela Barnes' campaign. So not having to spend a lot of money in a primary race, you know, is helpful. The consolidation of a message. But the point is well taken by Jeff. And as to the extremes, the candidates being the extremes, Barnes would argue that he's not extreme. In fact, he really tried to frame really progressive liberal policy items through his upbringing as a middle class kid from a union family. He kept going back to that kind of kitchen table style while mentioning things like Medicare for all or fast action on climate change, etc. But it is going to be a race where each side is calling each other extreme, with, you know, the Barnes campaign and others looking at Ron Johnson, the January 6th role that he played in terms of his office, and the fake electors from Wisconsin and I believe it was Pennsylvania, trying to get them to Mike Pence. And just his comments on things like the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccine. So that's, you're going to hear about that. And you're also going to hear about Mandela Barnes wanting to defund the police based on a tweet that he put out years ago. Also, there's a picture of him holding an Abolish ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, T-shirt. And so that's what it's going to be like. It's likely to get a little nasty.
Talking about Wisconsin's upcoming election for U.S. Senate with Rich Kramer at our side, Eau Claire-based reporter. You can join in 800-642-1234. Chris now in Milwaukee. Chris, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. On my mind is this whole inflation deal. I've been dealing with this with coworkers and family members who are just oblivious to the fact that this actually all came from supply chain breakdown during COVID. And it's the entire world that is suffering from inflation. The Ukraine war, for example, hasn't helped matters any either. And I just wish that Democrats would start showing this and saying, listen, yes, there's inflation. But, you know, over in the UK, their gas prices are three times the amount that ours are.
Chris, thank you for that. Rich, you know, Chris, yeah, bringing up how inflation has become a political tool, a political weapon. But, you know, Chris would like to look more closely at that messaging.
Absolutely. I mean, the pandemic created a global shock and continues to in some nations. You know, China is no stranger to locking down entire parts of its nation because of the COVID-19 pandemic. New cases emerge. It's a very complicated issue, but what I was told by Jessica Taylor at Cook was that, you know, if you're explaining, you're losing in an election. So, you know, I am certainly not an expert on campaign strategies, but that really rang with me. It was interesting to hear that because then I thought of examples. Sure. You know, if you're on your heels about an issue, it's just distracting from your message. So it will be interesting to see. I think it's easy to point to a person or a party and say it's their fault. It's not as easy to explain that, you know, this is much more complicated than what the other side is saying.
We have just a few seconds left. You warned us that there are going to be negative ads on this journey. There's going to be mudslinging. How should we watch these? How should we digest these?
Well, I guess I would suggest kind of taking the approach I take with news sources, you know, different publications. Take it all in and be skeptical and just make up your own mind about things. Try to take in all the information you can from the campaigns themselves, from the ads, but also from analyses and, of course, WPR News.
Rich, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate.
Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based out of Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.